The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, October 19th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Yeah, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, research professor Kate Crawford, research professor at USC Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism, author of The Atlas of AI, Power, Politics, and the Planetary Costs of Artificial Intelligence. Meanwhile, speaking of an absence of intelligence, White House in full court press to close a deal on the Build Back Better bill. Meanwhile, a vote in the House charging Steve Bannon with criminal contempt of Congress for his refusal to testify in front of the January 6 hearings. Speaking of criminal charges, Representative Jeff Fortenberry of Nebraska apparently expects to be indicted for lying to the FBI about some campaign contributions. Chair of the New York State Democratic Party, Jay Jacobs, sort of half apologizes for his bizarre attack on India Walton, the Democratic nominee for mayor of Buffalo, who also happens to be a socialist. Meanwhile, Democrats scale back their IRS reporting provision in the Build Back Better bill in a sop to enraged Republicans. DOJ files a brief with the Supreme Court to halt that Texas abortion ban. And the Supreme Court, meanwhile, bolsters shields for police brutality, because why not? Two more House Democrats announced their retirement in 2022. More reasons to think the Dems won't hold the House. And a federal judge rules that the University of North Carolina can consider race in its admissions. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Tuesday. Thank you for joining us. Glad you could make it. And here, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
All right. That's it. Just a hello.
Basketball day.
Oh, yes. NBA opener today.
NBA opener. Yeah. And, of course, the Red Sox had almost like a basketball score last night against the the Astros.
Almost.
Double digits.
I wanted to watch that game, but it seemed like 5 hours long. I watched an entire movie, and it was like the fourth inning.
It was fantastic. It was really a lot of fun.
The Rangers won in overtime. Kind of the same as getting closer to the World Series, but, you know.
There we go. It's a very, very sporty day today. I want to read this email we got, just a brief email from a listener, because it's appropriate to what's going on around the country. We've got tens of thousands of John Deere workers on strike, and frankly, you could just sort of feel public sentiment building in support of these strikers. John Deere made something like $5.7 billion in profit last year. They're having supposedly the third quarter is like one of their best quarters ever. And You've got people who are like welders making less than $20 an hour.
I think I saw that the CEO had like an 160% raise.
Well, he's done very well. It's just all those workers just, yeah.
And they got a $2 to $3 increase over many years.
I think it was, yes.
Well, maybe they should try working 160% harder.
Right.
Yeah, there you go.
Pull yourself up by your mechanical bootstraps.
And of course, we have strikers. We have strike authorization with Kaiser. We're waiting to hear about Yahtzee. We still have nurses on strike in Buffalo and Worcester and in California as well. This coming from listener Christopher. Hello, MR crew. I'm an Air Force member, big fan of the show, who's been inspired by your coverage of the strikes regarding Kellogg's and others. I flew from California to Omaha for a class yesterday, and I decided to follow Sam's advice, grab a pizza, and support these guys and gals,
nice.
Show some solidarity. So I'm honored and lucky to have been there at the right place and time. I annoyed a local restaurant bar owner until he gave me a special price on five pizzas. Then I got four more from a nearby Papa John's. But the most important thing I learned today, the Kellogg spokesperson is claiming the employees volunteered, that's in quotes, to work extra shifts. The truth, according to the workers, is that they knew they'd have to work an extra 48 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they were simply choosing the best option. Some have kids to pick up from school, so they volunteer, in quotes, to work the extra hours in the morning versus the evening, so they still get off at a normal time and so on. There were several other tricks mentioned, but I don't want to go too long here. Anyways, Christopher is out there. He's going to be there in a while. He says kudos to everybody in the office and sends his condolences and admiration for Michael Brooks. He recognized Matt's Dakota accent the first time he watched the show. And he has more details from Omaha. He's had some pictures, apparently, in video, and we got to check that out. But we were racing through this. So, again, folks, if you see some strikers out there and you're in the locality of something like that, go bring them some pizzas. Honk your horns, whatever it is. Show your support for folks. The longer they're out there, the harder it is. And and any type of support you can give them, much appreciated. All right, let's get to this. As you know, we are really just sort of waiting for where the Build Back Better, that's the reconciliation budget bill, is going to land. And we hear reports that Kristen Sinema does not want the government to negotiate for pharmaceutical. I mean, it just almost seems, first of all, it's just insane that we don't do this already.
Mm-hmm.
But to think that there's a politician out there who is actively campaigning on the notion that the government shouldn't use its buying power to negotiate better deals on pharmaceuticals, that of course would be better for the end users, and frankly, even better for those of us not on Medicare, because it's going to save money in Medicare or improve Medicare, and we will all be on Medicare at one point in this country. To think that there's somebody who's actually like, you know, that's the hill that they want to die on. Joe Manchin, meanwhile, is calling for a cutback in the child tax credit below where Republicans even wanted it.
Yep.
Means testing all sorts of things. Apparently, Manu Raju at CNN, Manchin tells a group that he's not in favor of a carbon tax, and that's not being
a carbon tax.
A carbon tax. No, mind you, in the Build Back Better bill, there was a whole plan to get us off of fossil fuels.
He's already.
He deep-sticks that, and now he's killing a carbon tax.
Which is, I mean, a lot of Republicans are fine with the carbon tax, just to show where he's at in terms of, you know, his politics. As you say, with the child tax credit, he's below where some Republicans wanted
it as
well.
It's just absurd.
Yeah.
And after a meeting, here's Joe Manchin really feeling his oats, right? Because he's really feeling his oats. He comes out of the meeting, and
there's cameras there, so got to ham it up.
And here he is running into Bernie Sanders.
Here, get a picture. Get a picture of us. Get a picture of us, huh?
Oh, great.
We're talking. All right, we're talking.
You're going to have a resolution by the end of the week,
we're talking.
Like?
We're talking. We're going to make some progress.
Senator Sanders, you prepared to make some deep cuts to climate change and other things like that?
All right, guys, just watch the vehicle, please. Come on out. That vehicle's going to come out.
Yeah, Manchin goes into a big truck and Bernie goes into a little sedan there.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I know it's been reported that Manchin said something to the effect of, like, keep fighting Bernie. But it sounds like he's saying, have a good one, Bernie.
Yeah, there's no way he's keep fighting Bernie. He's pissed and he's deputizing some, like, Chris Coons coming out in Politico saying, oh, I know Manchin was a little upset that Bernie Sanders took out an op-ed in his hometown paper, what was it, the Charleston Gazette Mail in West Virginia. Wow, tough. Like, these are the consequences of your kinds of politics. And the Biden administration is deputizing Bernie to do this. And all Manchin can focus on in that moment is pulling in Bernie in this awkward fashion. Hey, let's get a picture for the gram, right? Maybe I'll get a few followers from the burn crowd.
It's hard to assess, like, you know, what's involved there. If Manchin isn't just coming over, you know, this guy he's a multi millionaire who has been incredibly corrupt. I mean, there's more and more information about the corruption that he's been engaging in West Virginia. Also sort of, you know, the football quarterback. I mean, people know the type.
I know, but that's how they described it in Politico and then contrast it with, you know,
with Bernie. My point is that there is, this is just a male thing, but it seems to me like that was an aggressive move by Manchin, either to sort of, you know, show that he's not intimidated by Bernie in some fashion, or it's like he wants to show that he's being collegial. I don't know.
It's the old Trump.
But I have a feeling it's the former with guys like that.
It's like when a rival guy at a party, like, you make everybody laugh and he says, you're really funny, but without laughing.
Yeah, exactly.
You're
exactly.
A funny guy, huh?
Yeah, you're a good guy.
You're a funny guy.
But meanwhile, this is how sort of sick and twisted this is. The individual personality quirks, or just the, I don't know, the millions of dollars that Manchin has made, stands to make, will continue to make. I mean, the guy has millions, if not, or close to it, invested in coal and fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera. That he will stand between Americans getting $300 per family, per child, or millions upon millions of Americans getting access to community college, or daycare, or universal pre-K, or saving the planet. And, I mean, it really is just stunning. And the same could go, obviously, for Kristen Sinema, too. I mean, it's there was a grand miscalculation by the White House, it seems to me. That, you know, there was a lot of people who felt, including around these parts, not that anybody listens to us, but I'm saying it was quite obvious. You strike while the iron is hot. I didn't incidentally make up that saying. You strike while the iron is hot. And after the COVID bill passed, there was an opening. There was a sense that there was a lot of momentum. They should have gone quick. Instead, the White House slow walked this and negotiated with the Republicans and tried to maintain some bipartisanship. They made the exact same mistake that Obama did. They kept saying over and over again, we learned a lesson, we learned our lesson, we learned our lesson. And they said it so many times that they, in practice, showed that they had not. Which is, you seize the moment when you have the momentum. Because if you go out there and you try and placate those who, I don't even know who they were, said that this needed to be a bipartisan thing, this is what you get.
And if you all trust right. The...
We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Kate Crawford on her book, Atlas of AI, power politics, and the planetary costs of artificial intelligence. Folks, a couple of sponsors today. If you own a business, you know there aren't enough hours in a day to waste playing phone tag. List of customers you need to reach doesn't get any shorter, especially when business is good. That's why local businesses everywhere turn to Podium. Podium makes every interaction as easy as sending a text, so everything that makes your business great can get done faster. Podium isn't just a better way to communicate, it's a better way to do everything. You gather reviews, you collect payments, even marketing to your customers. Podium makes it all as easy as pressing send. You won't just free up more time, you'll grow your business and get more done. With Podium, you'll close deals with customers before the competition even has a chance to call them back. This is great for local businesses, folks. You can join more than 100,000 businesses that already use Podium to streamline their customer interactions. Get started for free at podium.com/majority or sign up for a paid Podium account and get a free credit card reader. Restrictions apply. That's podium.com/majority. Also, speaking of businesses, we're a business here, as you know, Emma.
I do.
Well, and as you know, I've been talking about scaling our business. It's a journey of endless possibilities. Well, Shopify is here to help. You get tools and resources that make it easy for any business to succeed from down the street to around the globe. This is what Shopify does. It powers over 1.7 million businesses from first sale to full scale. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources that were once reserved for big businesses. So upstarts, startups, established businesses alike can sell everywhere and synchronize online and in-person sales and effortlessly stay informed. With Shopify, you can reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps. So you can go to Facebook, you go to Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, more. Synchronize your online and in-person sales, and you'll also gain insights as you grow with detailed reporting. It's more than a store. Shopify grows with you. For us, we use Shopify, small business that we have in the merch business. Our shop.majorityreportradio.com, completely powered by Shopify. So we get a good idea one day for a t-shirt. Boom, it's up the next day.
Nice.
Makes it super easy for us. And we get all the data that, you know, I can tell you how many hats are selling, how many shirts. Very convenient, helpful. Go to shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to shopify.com/majority right now. Shopify.com/majority. And lastly, getting a little cooler weather here. That doesn't mean you can't get dehydrated. One stick of liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates you faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, liquid IV tastes great. It's got flavors like watermelon, strawberry. Did I strawberry? Lemon,
I don't
lime.
Know what that was.
Well, there's also pina colada. There's a lot. We've got all of them here, actually. Enjoying a few drinks now? The holidays approaching, or just because you've been doing so throughout the entire pandemic?
Yeah, I mean,
liquid IV to the rescue. People are starting to travel again. Air flights, liquid IV contains 5 essential vitamins. More vitamin C than an orange and as much potassium as a banana. Healthier than sugary sports drinks. There's no artificial flavors or preservatives and less sugar than an apple. Has the optimal ratio of glucose, sodium, and potassium, delivers water and nutrients into the bloodstream. And on top of that, the company's donated over 4 million servings in response to COVID-19. Products are being donated to hospitals, first responders, food banks, and more. You know how I roll with this. Right now, I got my watermelon right here. I've finished my energy, the lemon ginger, my energy matcha liquid IV. Sometimes I'll go with the immunity boost with the tangerine if I'm drinking too much, but just now it's just basically my go-to. I keep hydrated during the show.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you how much I love this product.
I love it too.
Grab
my acai right here.
There you go. I'm not a big acai fan. That's why you get
I know. Well,
boxes.
That's why I get the extras.
Grab your favorite Liquid IV flavors nationwide at Walmart, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's code MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. All right. Want to welcome to the program Kate Crawford. She's principal researcher at Microsoft Research and professor at the USC Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism, author of Atlas of AI, Power, Politics, and the Planetary Costs of Artificial Intelligence. Here with Emma Vigeland. Kate Crawford, welcome to the program.
Hi, Sam. Hi, Emma. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for being here.
Let's start. I mean, help us out here. Like, just very broadly. I mean, obviously, I'm going to ask you, what is AI? And in many respects, that's what the book is about. But give us give us the parameters of what we're talking about, just so that everybody's on the same page here.
Sure, Sam. I mean, obviously, when we hear about AI a lot in the press, but also even in the technical literature, it really focuses on its algorithmic capacities and its data infrastructures. You know, we get a story about the way that AI is objective and immaterial. It's in the cloud. You know, we can use it to make really important decisions in criminal justice and education and healthcare. But the reality, of course, is that AI is much more than just technical approaches. It's actually a profoundly political technology that's making really quite extraordinary interventions into how we live every day. And so part of what I'm doing in this book is really looking at how AI is made in the fullest sense, you know, going all the way through the life cycle to see how it's really working and the impacts that it's having.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, this for some reason, this film came up the other day in the conversation, but it's reminiscent of Frederick Wiseman's Meat, where that documentary takes you through every aspect of meat, how it gets from one place to another, all the different parts, and you of course refer to your book as an atlas, and so it gives us the sort of the topography, but all the different sort of, I don't know, multi dimensions of this. So let's start with the I guess the sort of what AI does, and I don't think people ever really sort of contemplate this idea because it seems intangible. But the tangible implications of AI, you start in Nevada we are, or I should say, mining companies are mining a lithium. I mean, where how does that come into AI?
Well, you know, part of this is moving away from algorithmic abstraction and actually looking at the material production of AI. So I start the book on going on this road trip to the mines that are actually part of producing all of the components that make contemporary AI work. So I visit the last functioning lithium mine in the US, which of course is really important to the life cycle of AI for things like rechargeable batteries. Now, you have a couple of grams of basic lithium crystal in your iPhone, but something like a Tesla Model S car needs over 62 kilograms of the stuff, like large amounts. And we're looking at hitting real critical supply problems with things like lithium and rare earth. And this is part of the reason that, of course, the Biden administration back in February made it very clear that securing these sort of critical minerals was going to be critically important for the US in terms of its sort of geopolitical power. So by centering there, by looking at all of these processes of extraction and mining, it really actually transformed my thinking. I mean, I'm someone who's researched AI for almost 20 years and have thought about it in these kind of, you know, very abstract academic ways. But by going to places like mines, by going inside Amazon fulfillment warehouses, by going to the labs where the data sets are being made, it just transformed my thinking to realize that AI in so many ways is the extractive industry of the 21st century in a way that mining really was, I think in many ways, consolidating its position as the leading industry in the 19th century. So in this way, I'm really looking at extraction from the earth, from labor, and from data.
Which really, I think, flies in the face of the way that AI presents itself as separate from politics, right? Because you can look at some of the top lithium mining countries in the world, and for the United States, for example, that has certainly affected our foreign policy when it comes to, say, South America.
Absolutely. You see this in Bolivia, actually, which is the site of the richest reserves of lithium. And it's constantly a source of civil tension and war. And again, these kinds of stories have been kept at arm's length when we talk about technology as though, you know, things in the cloud are these sort of green systems that don't really leave these lasting planetary impacts, but they do. And so bringing those stories back in, looking at those kind of real sort of impacts of traditional mining as well as data mining is part of what I think we have to do to understand the kinds of costs that we're signing up for when we start using AI across so many of our industries and ways of living.
When you're looking at AI as a question of power, as opposed to just sort of like, you know, and how that power is, I guess, distributed throughout society and then within societies, what drives that, I guess, obfuscation of the real world elements versus, I mean, is that just, was that organic, or is there, are there interests associated with keeping people from thinking about lithium in Bolivia when they think about AI?
Oh, it's absolutely intentional. Actually, Hart and Negri wrote about this, about the sort of dual operation of abstraction and extraction. In fact, you know, Hart's been on your show and talked about this very phenomenon that by abstracting away the conditions of production, you can kind of in many ways continue to, produce these kinds of highly extractive economies. So by looking at the wider political economy of big tech right now, you see a very different picture. You see that in actual fact, these companies are, and we have to be really clear, we're looking at one of the most intensely concentrated industries since the railways. You know, really, depending how you count, you know, fewer than a dozen companies can do planetary scale AI, and they're becoming enormously more powerful and more wealthy since the pandemic. So by looking at those political economies, looking at the supply chains, both in terms of minerals and energy, but in terms of labor, we start to, I think, get a much more realistic assessment of what is happening with big tech. You know, it's not all just, you know, how we get to use cool apps. It's actually much more about this profound concentration of power that in many ways is exceeding traditional forms of regulation and governance. And that is intentional. You know, we've written previously about this sort of idea of enchanted determinism, you know, that AI systems are presented to us as though they're enchanted and magical. They're somehow superhuman, but at the same time, deterministic, you know, able to make, you know, highly accurate, you know, predictions about how decisions should be made or what will happen in the future. And that kind of ideology, I think, has brought us to this impasse where many governments are afraid to regulate these sectors. They have an enormous amount of power, and they're being treated as though their systems are essential to how we live and therefore could not possibly have any regulatory frameworks. And I think that's a real trap.
And there also seems to be in that world a sort of a mystification of, you know, where it just seems so similar to me with finance in this right. sense that government can't possibly understand what we're talking about. And, if there was anybody within, lawmakers or regulators who had the ability to sort of assess what we were doing and properly regulate us, they'd be working for us anyway because they could make a lot more money. And so there is just simply not the brain power associated with this. And so it's like as if like this, the knowledge we have, never mind the AI, the knowledge we have about the AI is almost like hyper religious or some form of crypto religion that you're just not.
Tech is all knowing.
You haven't been baptized
itself.
You haven't been baptized though. You don't know. You just don't know the religion here.
Yeah.
Right. And that type of tech utopianism has deep roots. You know, we can go back to, you know, the early kind of days of Silicon Valley, where it was, you know, all these stories about, you know, startup guys in their garages, and we're, you know, creating new economies for the world. And that belief that Silicon Valley is this sort of untouchable place of all of the things that we need to sort of have our lives work, I think has brought us to exactly that place. It's a combination of mystification and idealization without looking at what are the downsides of that same ideology, this idea of move fast and break things, of, you know, extract whatever you can get and make as much money as you can, and to hell with the externalities. And that, unfortunately, is the position that we're in right now. So I think in looking at what the next 5 years is going to be like in terms of particularly, you know, big tech and AI super companies, as they're described now, is we have to start thinking very differently about what would regulation look like? How should we relate to these companies? And how do we find real guardrails around the way that these tools are actually having so much influence over our lives? And that's something that, frankly, it's a muscle we haven't developed very well. And so we've really got this sector that has been allowed to run rampant. And we're starting to see, you know, some shifts. I mean, you can look to the EU right now. They've, of course, just come forth with the first ever omnibus draft act for AI regulation. It's not perfect, but it's a step in the right direction. It's trying to think about how should we be looking at the way in which systems like facial recognition are being allowed to operate in our cities, looking at things like emotion recognition and why that's such a problematic idea and why we should have much higher thresholds before that gets applied in things like job interviews or in classrooms. But we've still got a long way to go. And particularly in the US, we're coming from well behind the rest of the regulatory conversation.
I want to get to all of those specific, I guess, applications and to the broader question. But let's move through your atlas and head to an Amazon warehouse. I mean, we hear... I think we're pretty familiar in these parts with sort of the horrors of an Amazon fulfillment center. And, you know, people are used as, you know, almost as if they were robots on some level. There's that level of expectation that there would be, they'd have human needs. And that's all driven by AI as a technology. But what does AI do there that if someone just came down from the warehouse, you know, up above and just said, like, here are the rules, period. I drew them up and I figured this is, you know, I'm a big devotee of Frederick Taylor. And so I know exactly what you need to do in this warehouse. Wasn't generated by AI. Here it is. Like, what would be less or more problematic between that and or AI doing it?
Right. And this is a great question, Sam, because so many of us have read the stories about life inside fulfillment centers, and that name still troubles me to this day. But for me, there was something quite extraordinary about going in there, about seeing what it's actually like, about seeing how many workers are there, you know, wearing support braces and, you know, getting the sort of the free painkillers out of the, you know, the giant kind of dispensers, and then looking at the relationship to the rate, the so-called picking rate, the rate at which you're grabbing objects and shelving them or getting them back onto, you know, the delivery trucks. And to see that is really where the algorithmic systems come to bear. It's systems which are tracking your movements and tracking your, you know, so-called efficiency. And then if you fail to make that rate, you run the risk of being fired. So it's a constant type of pressure. But you ask this really good question of, does that make that much difference if it's an algorithm or a person? And this is why in many ways, I think what we're looking at right now, even with these, you know, very futuristic, you know, factories and warehouses, is really just an extension of a very old form of, you know, Taylor-esque factory management. We can really go back to the 1890s and see that the visions that industrialists had for how to exploit human labor to its maximum is really coming to bear right now. So you can absolutely look at that long tradition there and say, we're seeing, you know, another version of the same old story. But here's what's different. This is the piece that I think we don't pay enough attention to. It's the degree to which these systems have far more granular, intimate insights into what we're doing, what we're saying to people, how we're interacting. And even in the case of Amazon, looking down to the level of ligaments, of which muscles you're using over the course of the day. This, of course, was Bezos's response to all of the criticisms about not just the sort of the physical injuries, but also the psychological stress of working in these places. He said in his, you know, letter to the shareholders earlier this year, we've created this great new algorithm. It'll track the inside of people's bodies. We'll look at their muscles and make sure that they're, you know, really load balancing their day. Rather than say, for example, supporting unionization, which frankly would be a much faster way to be addressing some of these issues. So what we're looking at is, I guess, a deepening and a sort of a fractalization of those old logics of industrial capitalism, but now moving into this far more molecular experience of everyday work. And you know, of course, Amazon warehouses are one of the kind of powerful symbols of what this looks like, but it affects so many people and so many different kinds of jobs. You know, so many of us, again, working from home, if we're lucky, sitting in, you know, systems that are constantly watching us during the day, that are now used in what's called algorithmic bossware to compare, you know, who's the most efficient worker. So many of those systems have now spread right through the experience of contemporary work. And I think it is different. I think there is a set of logics that are actually widening the power asymmetries between workers and bosses.
So if I understand you, and there's like a similar dynamic that happened in the context of gerrymandering, people would argue in this country, that at one point, there's always been gerrymandering. It's just that the technology at one point sort of almost, not quantitatively, but qualitatively changed the nature of gerrymandering because it became, the technology allowed it to do so specifically that there was no almost like human error factor in all of the sort of notion of chance came out of it. And that's sort of what we're looking at here, but also coupled with the idea of instead of there being a manager on the floor who people can point to and say, that guy is, you know, a horrible, horrible, you know, he's got a whip. Instead, it's like, we're in some type of sort of techno, efficiency. And so there's nobody, and almost like corporatizes things even more. Like we're a couple of steps removed from humans actually imposing this on other humans.
Right. And it's very pernicious in the way that it is represented as somehow being more objective or more neutral than a person. So therefore, we should trust these systems. And they also become harder to fight. They become harder to organize against. If you know, if you've got an overseer or a manager or a person on the factory floor, you can point to them and say, hey, you know, I need to talk to you. This is not fair. These conditions are absolutely unacceptable. It's much more difficult when you have these kinds of dispersed algorithmic systems. And interestingly, they also have these psychological effects. There've been a lot of studies looking at things like automation bias, that people will have a tendency to believe a determination that's made by a machine, even if they see that that machine is flawed and keeps making mistakes. It's been shown in hospitals. It's been shown in fighter pilots. It's a very consistent effect. And we're starting to see this again in workplaces, that people are assuming, well, you know, if the algorithm says this, or if this is the most efficient way to organize this workplace, then it must be right. And I think we have to fight against that idea, because in many ways, I think it's being used to bolster increasingly problematic experiences of work.
Let's talk about data and the sort of the data collection, I guess, which is, you know, I guess the premise of how, you know, you're collecting data on the ligaments, as it were, or on people's faces, and then you start to whatever it is, and then you start to promote that. Like, what is specifically problematic about the amount of data that is collected from us? Is it just simply who controls it and what they're able to do now and in the future?
You know, that's part of it. I think, you know, many of us have been reading and thinking about the amount of data extraction that goes on, you know, every time you walk in down the street, or, you know, you go to work or you go to university, that there are forms of tracking and data collection all the time.
I don't think like most people realize that they're all, almost all of their apps, short of the Majority Report app, is just, you know, this guy goes to the post office and then every day walks and gets a coffee here, and that data is sold because it has value to, you know, a hedge funder who wants to know where to put you know, I don't know a target or whatever it is, right? I mean, like, the I don't think people have that level of awareness of just how much data is being collected at any point. And then I think a lot of people are like, so what? I mean, people can see me go into the coffee shop.
Wait, well, let's take those in turn. Like, first, you know, I don't think it's people's fault that they don't realize that that's happening, because in many ways, these apps and many services are a shell game. They say, oh, you're using this because, you know, you want to play Pokemon. And actually what's happening is we're using that to map your location over time. And we're going to sell that data for a whole lot of other reasons. Now, that's really just obfuscation. That's sort of hiding what's actually going on. I mean, many people think Facebook is there so that you can communicate with your friends and family. But actually, you're feeding one of the largest AI facial recognition systems in the world, with more than 350 million images being uploaded every day, with people helpfully tagging images for free. That has created a completely different type of company that is doing very different sorts of things than what you might think of when you just, you know, look at the company's supposed, you know, mission in the world. So I think in many ways it's structurally been set up so that people don't understand. And so when people say, oh, I don't care, I often think that's because people aren't being shown the stakes. Like, what does it matter? Because what we're starting to see is that many of these systems that were previously quite discrete and disconnected are now being mapped together. So data from one space is being sold to another, which is being sold to another. So you're actually starting to see a whole host of new predictive privacy harms of situations where you might be applying for a job, but they're actually looking at data about you that comes from a whole range of activities that you would have no idea. This, of course, has been happening for a long time around loans in the banking sector, but it's now shifting into far more areas of life. So I think once people see the stakes of what's actually happening, people care. It's that in many cases, we're not being told what the stakes are, and they're being intentionally hidden from these really important public debates that we need to have about the role of these systems.
So it creates this, you know, surveillance infrastructure, essentially, and then we're talking about the depoliticization of the conversation surrounding it. People understand that the government surveilling them is a problem. I mean, there's a reason that I think a lot of people were concerned after the Edward Snowden revelations, rightfully. But there is a much less greater understanding of exactly what you describe. What do you attribute that to? Is it because people like playing Candy Crush, which I do too, or is it because they like Instagram? I mean, and also, is it because there isn't a, like a Joe Biden at the head, or government officials that you can point to in that area?
Well, now that you've brought Candy Crush into it, Emma, I mean, this whole thing. I mean,
game over.
Right?
I mean, level 1,200 or 1,202 or something insane.
Right?
Like that.
Yeah. Exactly. So, I mean, we could talk about that. But, I mean, of course, people are going to enjoy using game technology and systems that are fun to connect with people. That's okay. That's not the issue. It's the way in which these systems are not being regulated on the back end. It's the way in which that data is being used to actively harm us and often marginalized communities. So let's get to this point that you raised, which I think is incredibly important, which is, why is it that when Snowden released all those important documents to Laura Poitras and we found out what the NSA and GCHQ were up to, people were outraged? And I was really fortunate at that time that Laura Poitras gave me access to the documents to start looking at what is in fact a deep intertwining of both the state and corporate sectors at the level of these technologies. We tend to think of them separately. We tend to think of Google's over here and NSA's over here, but they use remarkably similar techniques and systems, particularly when you look at machine learning and AI more specifically. So what we've seen is, in some ways, like a filtering down of types of targeting techniques and use of metadata that was primarily the preserve of the intelligence agencies to be used in extra legal contexts in places that were, you know, people's rights were obviously being completely abrogated, that is now filtered down to the municipal level, where it's being used against undocumented workers, against kids in classrooms, against people trying to apply for jobs. So it's that way in which we've seen this entwining and entanglement of private contractors and the state around technology, that you can start to see something much more complex, which is that those surveillance capacities have been woven into so many things that we use, and they're not regulated. And of course, Palantir here is another classic example. I mean, Peter Thiel used to sort of talk about the in-between space where companies can be, you know, that's his favorite term here, where, you know, companies can do the things that once only militaries could do, and you can sell it to the highest bidder. You can basically buy to have those tools. That's a problem. And we need to talk about what that does to democracies and what that does to the experience of civil society. So, you know, for me, you're pointing to one of the big issues that I don't think we talk about enough, which is that there's this some, I think, quite antiquated belief that the state and the corporate sector are completely separate, when in actual fact, we're looking at a sort of a multi-headed hydra here.
And I would add that I think most people don't realize that to the extent that police departments, government agencies have any type of check on what type of data they're allowed to collect, they often bypass it because they're allowed to buy it. Like they may not be able to surveil you directly, but they can pay for people who are surveilling you because they're in the private sector. And that is, I mean, we see that in the context of like you say, of all these different agencies. I'm also sort of fascinated by you talk about Ekman, who Paul Ekman, who had developed, I guess it was the nine set, was it nine, or there was a small set of
six universal emotions.
Universal emotions.
Right.
And I'm fascinated by this because I think like what happens on some level is that, you know, these are the six emotions and then they are supposedly extracted from us, but then they're reimposed back on us. And it dictates, it has the potential to dictate a lot of things to us that are, you know, sort of like maybe not so clear cut. I mean, can you walk us through that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is the story of so-called emotion recognition, AI, and you encounter it in all sorts of ways every day. It's used in airports. It's used in shopping malls. Again, it's used by, you know, HR and particularly in hiring processes around interviews. So what's extraordinary, and this really blew me away when I was researching this book, is going back to where this idea comes from, that you can predict somebody's inner emotional state by their external facial expressions. Now, any of us who've ever worked in the service sector or in a cafe can tell you that when you're smiling, doesn't mean you're having a great day. But of course, this assumption goes all the way back to this psychologist who was working in the 1960s, Paul Ekman. And he had this idea that we have a very limited set of universal emotions that we show in our face. And he did a series of studies that, you know, have been deeply critiqued ever since. But even then, you know, you had anthropologists like Margaret Mead saying, this is a really bad idea. There aren't universal emotions. Everything is culturally specific. It's relational. It changes depending where you are and who you're talking to. But he took this idea and ran with it, and it became incredibly powerful. It was built into systems of detecting whether people are potential terrorists in airports by looking at, you know, signs of stress and fear. And, you know, guess who else is stressed and afraid when they're in airports? You know, all the communities who, you know, experience harassment in exactly these kinds of spaces. There are so many kinds of problematic, racialized and gendered ideas that are built into these systems. But at its core, this idea that we have six universal emotions that we show on our faces is unscientific. And yet it's been built into AI systems all throughout society. And so this is one of those moments where if you really start to press on what are the assumptions of how these systems are built, you actually find it's paper thin. And moreover, it continues to have impacts that most harshly impact those communities who've already experienced the greatest downsides. And again, we see this over and over again. It's affecting the poor. It's affecting women. It's affecting communities of color. So this is why when we start to talk about AI, I think of it as politics all the way down. It is many cases fronting as forms of science. But if you really do the work, you find that many of these scientific precepts and assumptions have been critiqued for years. There's actually a great study that was done by a psychologist by the name Lisa Feldman Barrett. This was a couple of years ago now. And she looked at every single study that claims that you can predict somebody's inner state from their face. And she showed there was no reliable correlation. So this claim in all of these technical systems is actually not true. And it reminds me of things like the polygraph. Like, it really takes me back to technologies like that, which is why I think we need to push back much harder on the way that these systems are being deployed.
So, I mean, the problems start from just, you know, bad inputs is going to necessarily give you bad outputs. And then it's also the application of these outputs that are also problematic. I mean, I just like the range in which this is being used. There was a story of the county escapes me in California where they actually have, you know, pre-crime unit where they're going and going with police officers and social workers, and they're knocking on people's doors and they're saying, we have determined that you're either going to shoot somebody or get shot. And I'm not joking about this, within the next, you know, 18 months. And so we just wanted to give you a heads up. There was one story of a guy who people in the neighborhood saw the cops come up to his door, and he ended up getting shot twice because they thought he was snitching on people in the neighborhood. And you can extrapolate that, I guess, to in a bigger sense across society. But all right, so let me ask you this. When we talk about regulation, is there enough regulation that could exist? When we talk about the concentration of this power, I wonder if there is enough regulation, or if we need to make it just fundamentally harder to concentrate this power and make it just far less a profitable exercise to even attempt it.
Right. I mean, and this is why I think we need a theory of power when it comes to big tech. And that's a big focus of Atlas of AI and why I wrote the book, is to really start to look at these forms of power, which in many ways exceed traditional forms of legislation. And we can look at the histories of how legislation has emerged around industries that were causing forms of harm. In fact, one of the things I look at in the book is, of course, you know, when Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle, you know, this was actually, you know, a great book about, you know, workers' rights and the need for sort of socialism. But the way that people interpreted this book, because it was set in, you know, Chicago's meatpacking district, was that it was about these terrible food practices. And then we start to see, you know, acts passed so that we can have, you know, better mechanisms for clean food, rather than looking at the underlying dynamics. And so this is what worries me in what I see about the sort of the current regulatory discussions in the US, is that they're moving at the sort of peripheries. They're not looking at the underlying political economy that's driving these systems to be as profitable as they are, because they don't have to pay for their full costs. So I think you're pointing to one of the biggest challenges that we're going to face over the next few years, which is how do we come up with a much more profound accounting for what these systems do and how they should be reined in, rather than just looking at changes at the margins. And for me, this, you know, the people who've been talking about this for decades are in many cases the activists who've been working on these core issues. You mentioned predictive policing. Predictive policing is so widespread across the US now. I mean, that's one county in California. This has become a standard way of operating for the police in this country, even though we know that the absolutely core assumptions that it's built on are problematic. So we're starting to see more and more technologies used to bolster these kinds of power that I think in many ways have exceeded regulation. So we have to look at a couple of, I think, much more significant changes. One of those has to be deciding what kind of world do we want to live in, and why do we keep centering technology as the major actor of change? And secondly, how do we get to a politics of refusal? how do we get to a place where we say, no, we don't want facial recognition here. No, we don't think predictive policing is actually working in any way. How do we get to that place? Because I think that's a much bigger question than just, you know, passing an act around, you know, how do you regulate AI systems?
But if we get that, I guess, that far out in terms of an appendage of like, you know, what do we do about predictive policing? And I don't think most people even really are aware of it, frankly. I mean, it seems to me, I guess, and maybe it's just because this is my bailiwick, like, maybe the problem with big tech is the big. I mean, and that other things become easier after it's not big. I mean, because, you know, we can look at industries like the fossil fuel industry that sort of hid the externalities for so long that they now become the industry itself becomes too powerful. Once we're aware of the externalities and we've fully sort of like come to grips with it and we understand it now, they're now just too powerful, it seems, whether it's Joe Manchin or somebody else, to actually sort of do anything about. Like, maybe the first step is the big part, and then we worry about the tech parts.
Right. I mean, and this is a very popular argument right now, which is we should break up the big tech companies. And you can see how that's really appealing, that this would be in some ways starting to disarticulate companies that have so many different types of functionalities under one roof. But what worries me, and certainly what I look at in the book, is that some of the core mechanisms by which these systems are being designed are unjust. If we actually look at the way they're understanding and depicting the world, if we look at the way that they use enormous amounts of energy to work, if we look at the types of exploited labor that go all along the supply chain to sustain them, just breaking up Facebook, for example, isn't going to address those underlying industrial dynamics. So while I think it's certainly a nice thing to have, do I think it's going to profoundly shift these bigger questions around asymmetries of power and tech? Not enough. So I think it's part of a much bigger set of solutions that we need to start thinking about. In no way do I think it's the silver bullet.
Right. No, I'm not saying it's a silver bullet, but I think it's like, you know, it's really a question of sequencing, right? I mean,
right.
How do you get to deal with the things of the various silos of things that Facebook is doing that may be problematic when you have the power of Facebook basically, you know, hiding the ball on all those things? It seems to me much easier to go in and regulate 50 small companies than one that has the revenue coming from all 50 of those. I mean, that's why, right? I mean, that's why in businesses, in industry sectors where you have a bunch of small companies, they form trade groups because they know they have more power that way. And the power is to prevent the government from minimizing or in any way mitigating their profit accumulation. But let me ask you this too, because you work for Microsoft. How happy are they with you?
Well, I work for a very weird part of Microsoft called Microsoft Research. And that's kind of basically this very unusual historical construction that's been around for about 30 years that really allows and brings in academics to work in their specific fields and says, you come and work on what are the big issues for the next 10 to 30 years, like the big horizon stuff. Now, you know, obviously I'm really critical of some of the kind of major systems that Microsoft is a part of, but part of my job is that is what I do, is to actually point to, if these things don't change, we're looking at a very serious problem, not just now, but 10 years from now. And that's the piece that, you know, frankly, I've been saying for 20 years, and I'll be saying more, is that has to come from people inside industry and outside. We need everybody starting to say, this is an unacceptable way of actually building systems, and looking much more closely at the kinds of assumed bases of production that have gone into big tech. And frankly, if you think about some of the big debates this year, that they've come from people inside tech companies. Sometimes it's whistleblowers. Sometimes it's people who've quit over things that they say, we don't want to build this. We should be listening to those people. Those people know what's going on. They've seen on the inside how these systems work. And they're saying, there's a problem here and we have to do much better.
Kay Crawford, the book is Atlas of AI, Power, Politics, and the Planetary Costs of Artificial Intelligence. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. Really interesting.
Sam, Emma, it's been a pleasure. Look forward to talking again in the future.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, folks, quick break. We'll be right back. Wrap things up. There it is, folks. The power of big tech. I am still very much of the mind that it is not a silver bullet, but it is a good first step. In fact, the best first step is to diminish the power of tech so that instead of big tech, it's medium-sized tech. Smallish tech. Yeah. And then much easier to do all of that other regulation. But this is a conversation we're going to have for a while. And, you know, if we get anything out of the Biden administration, maybe it will be at least some measure of antitrust. But we'll see. In the meantime, if you're watching us on Peacock, we say goodbye and see you tomorrow. And if you are not watching us on Peacock, I will say hello.
Hello again.
And, you know, we have an announcement. I will probably at one point maybe make it to the Peacock people. But we are winding down our participation on Peacock.
Yes.
Over here at the Majority Report.
Putting our feathers back down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We are not going up. We're not. What is that called when you...
We're no longer the...
Is it peacock?
Preening? Yeah. Preening?
Preening. Oh,
yeah. Preening. We're less no preening. Longer the cock of the walk.
We've been on the app, the choice by MSNBC for a year. And our option is, you know, we're there. And frankly, doing an extra show every day, which Emma and I have been doing now for 7-8 months after the show, is not easy. And I think it's ultimately for the best. I'm not going to say like I'm ecstatic, but to have the extra time, I don't get ecstatic about anything, but I'm a little bit happy. I'm a little bit happy. I'm a little bit happy. So
you're happy because you're getting that extra cash to stay silent about all the things you know.
Obviously. All the deep dark secrets.
Yes.
That they tell me about all of the people I've never met. all the people I've never met nor been on their show. In fact, I have not been in a building with any of the people that we worked with. I mean, I didn't have much contact. We had a licensing deal. So they would take the majority report. And really the only editorial that they would have was like visual. And they and the show looked better on Peacock than it does here, because they had graphics and they did a really good job of that. But it just got to be too much. And so but it was fun while it lasted. And I do, Emma and I were just talking about this, like we keep running into stories like, oh
yeah, we should do a knee jerk show.
And it's hard because there is, I have always been like at war with myself about at different times to like, God, I'd like to cover this story, but it doesn't, you know, we do longer form interviews, and there've been times during the course of the show where, you know, we've had some days where we'll do like two guests and we'll do two reporters on or something like that. We may go back to that on some days, because there's just a lot of stories out there that just you just don't hear about unless you're like, you know, sort of a voracious news reader. And that was the best part of doing the second show, which we call Reported.
Yeah, highlighting all of those reporters that we weren't able to necessarily cover on the majority report.
And just the pre-crime unit that I was reciting was from a story that I interviewed those people. I mean, so much of, you know, it was like going to school, frankly, a lot of times. And, you know, that's the part that I'm going to miss. But it was also exhausting to have a second deadline every day.
And to just keep track of what you could and could not say based on the money that was given to you by NBC.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
Don't worry, guys. Glenn. We got enough money, so we'll keep up our...
Glenn doesn't watch the show.
We'll keep up our MSDNC like charade,
no, that's not,
even as this is sunsetting.
Yeah, no, that's not... but be that as it may, that was... So that's that. I mean, so we're going to still... They're still carrying the majority report every day until the end of this month. Second show just ended last week for us. Friday... And, but that material will still be available on Peacock, I believe. Mm. I'm not exactly sure how they'll handle it. But you can go there and check that out over on the Peacock app. I wish I could give you a link for it, but that was, you know, one of the sources of frustration, the technology. All right, so let's...
couldn't help yourself.
No, I couldn't. All right, folks, just a reminder, more than ever, it is your support that keeps the show alive. You can help us survive and thrive by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get extra content virtually every single day. And as members, we're just going to be giving you more and more bonuses. One is you get the code. If you go to your member post, you will find the code for pre-sales for the show in Boston at the Wilbur Theater, January, 16th at 3 p.m. So go into the member post at majority.fm. Also, if you sign up for the AM Quickie newsletter, go to majority.fm, scroll down, put your email address in there. It will be in the AM Quickie newsletter tomorrow. So you will get that code. You'll be able to buy your ticket. Make sure that you get one. I mean, I got to be honest. Do I think it's going to sell out by Friday? Probably not. But do you really want to risk that?
Yeah, don't risk that. Do you not want to risk our live show, which will just be putting up Jimmy's tweets and then laughing at them?
It really, it's all negative, like, for you. It's all oppo for you today.
I mean, I don't know about that.
But there it is. You also just gave away spoiler alert on the whole show plan, too.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
That would have actually been funny to do.
If I take off my glasses, maybe I'll be nicer.
What?
It's a change in, I don't know.
That's very strange. The glasses make you mean?
I'm cleaning and thinking out, just like, what's happening Where's in the Nomi? Mad Lackean Let's bring universe?
Nomi. Well, no, wait, we're not there yet.
Okay.
Also, don't forget, you can join the Discord at majoritydiscord.com. Where's Nomi? All right, well, Matt, why don't you tell us what's happening in the Matt Lackean universe?
God, it wasn't time yet.
So,
well, we need to wait now 30 seconds. Now it's time. As soon as she puts her glasses back on, she's mean again.
I'm a bitch again. Only I can say that.
Yeah,
I would never say that.
Branko Marcetic is going to be on Left Reckoning this week, but we did a... Well, actually, I'm going to plug Literary Hangover. Literary Hangover, I did an episode, final episode on William Byrd II's Diary. Go check that out. I'm going to be doing John Milton and Daniel Boone in the coming months, so look forward to that, folks. And go subscribe to the Left Reckoning YouTube channel. Where I did a segment on Russell Brand that people will want to check out.
Oh, I want to see that. Ooh.
Big apology segment.
Really?
I'm trying to get him from the geeks. So.
Yeah, you know, I probably would have, I think I agree with that tack.
I think he's genuine. I think he's just sort of swirling around the Rogan whirlpool right now.
Mm.
I saw him live and then, oh, Nomi's here, sorry.
Nomi!
Okay.
Hey!
I don't care.
Where's the background?
It's too much. It's too much to set up today.
Oh, you got to turn down your microphone just a little bit.
The gain's a little high.
You're a little bit hot.
Little high.
There we go.
How's this?
Even better. Maybe a little bit more even.
Ooh.
It's really
hot. I don't know what I did. God, every time you plug this thing in, it's like different results. Not everybody has a multi-million dollar, billion dollar studio like you, Sam, okay?
Right.
I mean, it's true. I mean, this doesn't, you can't replicate this unless you're David Packer, apparently.
But he couldn't get the colors right. Like,
he couldn't get the colors right. No, I had these colors actually created. They were not, they're not off the shelf. They're specifically created for the show.
They're sustainable. Like you took berries and squished them and
yeah, of course.
You
know,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah. What are we talking about? Who's on my show? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So today on Rockfin, we have Harvey K, who's just obviously it's been a while since we caught up. So we're going to do an hour with Harvey K talking about, what's really going on in Washington. And then, tomorrow on the show on, patreon.com/TheNomiKey Show. And of course, youtube.com/TheNomiKey Show and Twitch_ just search bar on Twitch. We're going to be talking about the anti-Asian roots of today's anti-immigrant politics with Mari Uehara and Jordan Zacharin from A More Perfect Union and Napoleon the Legend are joining us. So it's going to be a fun show. And on Fun Friday, we have Francesca Fiorentini and I think Kate Willett is also joining us. I think I got word. So it's going to be a comedy Fun Friday.
Oh, that's great.
Nice.
Yeah. Be fun.
Both those guys are great. All right, we're going to head into the fun half. We got to talk to you about what's going on with the Democratic Party in New York State.
Mm, the Walton and such.
The head of the Democratic Party.
Jacobs.
Yes. Ooh, what's wrong with that dude? And also,
Long Island. That's what's wrong with him. Sorry, Long Islanders. It's not that.
Well, Chuck Schumer also seems to be sort of running scared from the Democratic nominee in the city of Buffalo. That's weird. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
No. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throne.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the breaks to break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on! To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.